You're listening to Engage with Andy Bush. To connect with the program today, please send an email to andrew.bush@comcast.net. That's andrew.bush@comcast.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome back to a special energy edition of Engage. I'm your host, Andy Bush. You know, given the enormous interest in hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, I thought it would be just awesome to have on someone who covers these topics for one of the largest news services on the planet, Reuters, or Thomson Reuters, however you want to put it, but it's Reuters on the web. John Kemp is a senior market analyst based in London and covers the energy space for them. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andy. Pleased to be on.
All right, well, let's do something right away because I truly want to help you in the sense that I love his blog. So how can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can follow me on Reuters at JKemp Energy, on Twitter, or I have a blog on the internet, blogs.reuters.com/John-Kemp/. Or indeed on the Reuters terminal on icon, and I have a named item code there, Kemp/.
Wow, you are in more places than, a 7-Eleven. That's awesome. while both of our countries have been watching the World Cup finals from the sidelines, sadly, and yours actually bowed out a little sooner than mine, thank goodness. you have been busy researching and writing on the energy sector. You know, I want to focus today on your article specifically about the shale revolution in the United States and how most of us really get it wrong. This is what you wrote: when we zero in on fracking instead of horizontal drilling, why has horizontal drilling been such a game changer with domestic oil production in the United States?
Well, let's think a little bit about the geology and then it becomes pretty clear. I mean, most oil and gas is found in big sedimentary basins, layers of sand and silt laid down over hundreds of millions of years on the floor of ancient seas, lakes, riverbeds. Mm-hmm. And the oil and gas are the cooked remains of plants and animals that died before and were buried before they could decay fully. And some of those layers contain much more organic material and therefore much more oil and gas than others. And oil drillers are sort of hunting around below ground looking for just the right oil-bearing formations, often 2,000, 3,000 meters below the surface, and the oil-bearing formations often only sort of 50 or 100 feet thick. I guess the best way to think of a sedimentary basin is it's a bit like a stack of pancakes, and each pancake is quite thin, maybe only 100 feet, even though it might extend over an area that is hundreds or thousands of square miles. Now think about the trajectory of those wells. Vertical wells only make contact with maybe 50 or 100 feet of rock, and they're great when the rock is nice and permeable, it's got lots of pores, it's very easy for the oil and gas to flow to the well. They're not so great when the rock is tightly packed like shale. Mm-hmm. And the advantage of a horizontal well is it can travel along that shale formation for hundreds of meters, even in some cases now kilometers, making much more contact with the reservoir and enabling a lot more oil and gas to be produced. So that's really why horizontal drilling in many ways is the big technological marvel. I mean, fracking is great, and it's something that the United States has been doing really since the 1940s, 1950s in a big way. Horizontal drilling, which really only took off about 1990, is actually the really big breakthrough that has enabled the shale revolution to take place.
Well, I love the fact that you put it in terms of food, because that for most males out there, we can understand that, right? Pancakes, I love it. Also with that, John, is the fact that unlike other countries, let's say China, for instance, the United States is extraordinarily well-mapped when it comes to geologically. So I think we have a better understanding in this country of where this stuff is. And now we have the technology, whether it's the motors or the tubes or the piping, to get to it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the level of surveying and mapping is an enormous advantage, and one which very few other countries around the world share. I mean, mm-hmm. You can go back, there's a fantastic, the American Association of State Geologists has an amazing website. And the first state geological surveys were being set up in the 1830s and 1840s, and they were specifically being created by American states that wanted to understand their mineral wealth, wanted to be able to exploit it more effectively. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 19th century, virtually every state in the United States has its own geological survey or something equivalent. The American Association of State Geologists starts meeting every year from 1908, and it starts meeting with the U.S. Geological Survey, a federal organization set up all the way back in 1879. So this has created this huge repository of knowledge. The other thing that a lot of people fail to understand is that when you drill an oil or gas well in the United States, although you can keep a lot of that information proprietary for a period of time, eventually you generally have to hand over the well logs and the coring data to the State Geological Survey, and that then becomes part of the public record eventually. So we have an enormous knowledge about what actually lies below the surface. Let's just take one formation. Everyone talks about the Bakken.
Right.
The Bakken formation in North Dakota was discovered back in the 1950s. So we knew that that oil was there. In fact, we knew that that oil was effectively the source for most of North Dakota's other oil fields. We just didn't know how to get it until sort of 10 years ago, when they began to apply fracking techniques quite widely to it. So we knew it was there. As soon as you move away from North America, our knowledge of the subsurface geology starts to get much sketchier, even in countries that have fairly well-established oil industries like Russia or China. The level of exploration is just so much lower. There's a plus side and a minus side to that. The minus side is that in the short term, it makes it much more difficult to do some of this kind of shale work because we just don't know the subsurface nearly as well. The upside,
right,
potentially, is there could be a lot more oil and gas out there to be discovered once we start doing the survey work.
Yeah, and I think that was what was interesting this week when you wrote about one of Russia's largest oil areas, and equating it to the size of California and Texas combined. And I think that's what's exciting about this technology. And it makes me kind of laugh about how back in the 70s in the United States, we thought we were at peak oil, right? And then there was the book, famous book, Midnight in the Desert, I think it was, who
yep.
predicted that Saudi Arabia was going to reach a peak oil period as well. You know, looking forward, I mean, I think what's exciting about this is obviously the potential for somewhat energy independence for North America. But you have to wonder, you know, are we in a peak drilling situation right now? And where is this energy boom going? Is it going to slow down in 3 to 5 years, John?
I mean, I think the short answer to that is no.
Good.
There is the potential to produce an awful lot more. I mean, people have been worried about peak drilling for a very long time. I mean, one of my all-time heroes, a U.S. geologist called Carl Beale, published a book on this in 1919, and he thought that the United States, even then, was reaching a sort of peak oil production situation.
Oh, my gosh. So even back in 1919, somebody was calling for peak oil.
Absolutely. So this isn't a new concern. One of the very valid points that he made is, you know, we've got more and more oil wells, but as they decline, we have to drill more and more wells just to replace them, let alone grow the production, and that there must be some sort of limit. We must reach a point where we just can't drill any more wells.
Mm-hmm.
What he kind of failed to understand was that drilling could get a lot faster, it could get a lot more efficient, so we could drill more wells more quickly. And he also failed to grasp that or to imagine how productive those wells could be, that we could use modern technology like seismic surveying to target our wells much more precisely for the absolutely most productive parts of oil-bearing formations. So we can drill more wells, we get more oil out of those wells on average. And that means that there's no real reason why we can't extend the energy boom for another 3-5 years. In fact, I think that the oil boom in North America will keep going as long as the demand is there and the prices remain high. It's the demand that is leading the supply rather than the other way around here. So I don't think we need to worry about peak oil, although from a, you know, switching hats a little bit, there is enough oil and gas down there to cook the planet many, many times over. We will never run out of oil and gas in our lifetime, in our kids' lifetime, in our grandchildren's lifetime. We don't really need to worry about that. We maybe need to worry a little bit more about what happens if we dig it all out of the ground and burn it, and what that does to the climate.
Right. Well, you know, you brought up a really interesting point, is that you said demand drives the supply. But, you know, in the United States, we're seeing something really fascinating happen. It's been happening for a number of years. Obviously, you know this better than I do. But it's the drop in miles driven by U.S. Car owners that's fascinating. And, of course, with the development of a lot of the things that are happening in the green space, we're seeing less and less demand. That's a theme that's going to continue along with this energy production. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things people fail to understand a lot of the time, or don't think about, is how deep and how long the cycles are in the oil industry. So in the same way that the first oil shocks, 1973, 1979, provide the motivation to develop North Sea oil, Alaskan oil, Soviet oil, mostly in the 1980s. And that then eventually brings in a collapse in oil prices in 1986, and it takes the best part of 15 years to work off all of that spare capacity, basically mm-hmm. through a period of very low prices. What we're now seeing is the legacy of the third oil shock that was sort of 2004 to 2008. That huge rise in oil prices has had two effects. One is it's incentivized all of this shale production, but it's also led to an enormous amount of demand destruction. Now, some of that is voluntary. People are changing their behavior in response to much, much higher energy prices. Some of that is mandatory, it's legislation. You can go back and look at the 2004 and 2007 big pieces of energy legislation in the United States, both of which imposed a biofuels mandate and also very tough energy efficiency standards for cars. And of course, those are still grinding away in the background. They're still every year taking more and more gasoline demand out of the system. So we're kind of living in what we're seeing today in terms of the oil market, in terms of rising supply, falling demand, has its roots back a decade ago when oil prices were surging higher.
Wow, that's a really great way of taking a look at this. And you made a wonderful point about the long cycles. And I think that's what was interesting for me back in 1999, when oil prices were $10 and they were actually destroying oil tankers. That's when a oil analyst, Jerry Castellini, who's got a hedge fund in Chicago, who's been on my show a couple of times, he was making the case that this is the time when you want to start to be buying energy assets. And so I think your point is really well taken. It's you have to understand the length of the cycle and also the implications for what's happening, because in their wake of the biofuels and the car efficiency standards, we now have demand coming down. At the same time, we have supply going up, which is wonderful from a number of standpoints in the United States, not only for oil but also natural gas. One of the cycles that I would add to that is when you have cheap natural gas, for instance, you also have companies who are pharmaceutical companies and other companies that use natural gas begin to look at building plants in the United States, and that's about a five-year cycle as well. So I think that's interesting that those are tied together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what people – this is a very – there are a couple of reasons for the deep cycles in this industry. One is it's immensely capital intensive.
Sure.
And I don't just mean the obvious stuff in terms of, like, you got to build big drilling rigs, big oil platforms. But the exploration work itself is very capital intensive. It takes a long time to discover a field, to survey it, to estimate its potential, to make a decision to go ahead and develop it, and that's very expensive. There's also a dimension in terms of the personnel. I mean, these industries use large numbers of highly skilled professionals, and it takes sort of 10, 15 years to train those guys. Now, in the 1990s, that period of very depressed oil prices, the oil companies were all cutting staff. They were cutting petroleum engineers. They were cutting people involved in seismic surveying.
Right, and no one was going into it as an education either, right?
I mean, it was a terrible career. And then suddenly when the oil boom hits in the 2000s, you don't have enough personnel. Now, the interesting thing is, you know, you've now suddenly this industry has become very sexy to work in. I mean, petroleum engineering is one of the highest paid professions in the United States right now. And the number of people actually working as petroleum engineers has sort of more than tripled. Back at the turn of the century, we were looking at only 10,000 petroleum engineers in the United States. We've now got about 38,000.
Amazing.
But it does take that long, and this is why these kind of very brutal boom bust cycles are kind of inherent in the industry. What I think we're seeing at the moment is you're coming off the back of a boom cycle, but with so much supply coming on train and demand falling, the real question is, are we kind of inevitably moving towards a period of lower prices? Because only lower prices can slow the development of some of these resources down. And I think, you know, from an investment perspective, the real question is, are we moving into maybe a softer price environment over the course of the next 5 years?
Right. All right. Well, John Kemp, Senior Market Analyst in the energy space. Thanks for coming on the show today. This is really awesome. I got to get you back on. I learn as much as the audience does today. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's been great to be on the show.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. When we get back, we'll talk and shift gears and talk about regulation in the energy space. This is Engage. I'm Andy Bush.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Inside Healthcare is the only radio program focused solely on the healthcare industry. We bring together new and experienced entrepreneurs and industry veterans from throughout the country who are changing the dynamic on how healthcare is delivered today. Join us as we ask the tough questions, explore current topics, and discuss the new partners and models in healthcare that successfully address the needs of population health across the country. Listen Mondays at 6 a.m. Pacific Time and Saturdays at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick and mortar locations or traditional bankers' hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and, of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.